All right, welcome to Planning Commission. Welcome, Dee. We're glad you're here. Do you have any public comments tonight? No. All right, so there's no public comments. We can't help you with that. Yeah, there probably is. All right, item three, work session. Sherry, take us away.
Last chapter.
Yay.
Okay.
How's that feel?
So this is chapter 9, essential improvements. Next year, next meeting, we'll do the final review and table contents. And then in December, we'll look at chapter 3 and chapter 7, what's left that we haven't transferred into the new title 13, and kind of those updates. And then we'll be ready for our public hearing in January. Okay, so chapter 9. Okay, so the first section is 13.9-10. So if you'll remember from last time, chapter 8 is dealt with the subdivision design. This one deals with the essential improvements or the infrastructure that goes into subdivisions. So the first section provides for the adoption and preparation of our design and specification standards, which are already done and they are published and they've been approved. So this just kind of goes into the, here's how those are made and here's where they're, where they are required that you meet those standards. The next section is a statement about the requirement of these of this infrastructure being the responsibility of the developer to install. Section 30 talks about the curb gutter and sidewalk and asphalt pavement. This one is basically saying that it's the developer's responsibility to install all of those improvements. So a lot of this is just legal jargon. Excuse me, dropped my pen there. Section 40 is the storm drainage one. So this is existing language, or majority of it is existing language from our code. Some proposed additions add some language for the 100-year storm events and adds language about pre-development hydrology for storm retention. So essentially, you can, when you look at a vacant site that is just native vegetation, the engineering will look at the site for what that site is currently retaining on site when we have a storm, and they have to have that, they have to keep that on site still, so they can't dispose of that or can't go into the storm drain, is my understanding on how that is supposed to work. And then there's some language about the basins that they have to make and designing to hold for a 10-year event, and for also for a 100-year event. And that language still has to be reviewed by the city engineer, because I'm not exactly sure if that addresses the issues that you brought up, Commissioner Jorgensen, but that's how that's where that's put in. And then there's some new language under the low impact developments. Those are LID things, so that relates to LIDs are practices where you maintain that storm water on site and you reuse it to water vegetation or various areas. And so this is a section that just talks about the Utah General Construction Permit and complying with that for the city's requirements. Any questions on those sections? I clicked twice. Okay, section 50 talks about underground utilities and the sanitary sewer. So there is a little bit of existing language and there's some updated language. This outlines the requirements that all utilities have to be underground, and clarifies some language regarding the extension of the sewer lines, that it has to go all the way to the property line, the property boundary of the subdivision, so that the next developer or the next development could be serviced by it. And then it specifically states that the plans have to be approved by the sewer district In practice, we send them to the sewer district, but we didn't have something in code that specifically said, hey, the sewer district has to approve these before we can approve the subdivision. The culinary water section is the next section at 60. Clarifies some, again, the same language about the extension of the water lines to the boundary of the development, and clarifies how the water mains and hydrants and services are required to meet the capacity requirements of the ordinance. One of the things that's kind of interesting from the culinary water section is that developments are supposed to bring actual water to the table, and for years we haven't done that because we were always told by the former engineer that we have all the water shares we need, but we have this in our code. And so we're going to, city engineer is going to look at this language because at some point it could become a problem, and she wants to make sure that we are collecting actual water, not just paper water. It can't be just water shares. We have enough water shares, but we don't necessarily have enough source for those water shares because you can only take so much water out of the aquifer. You can have lots of shares, but and most of the aquifers are over overextended on the shares they have issued over the last 100+ years. So let's see, the next section, section 70, talks about fencing and piping of hazards. That's a new section. So if there's a waterway or a canal, railroads or any other hazards identified, that they have to, the developer would have to fence those and make them safe or pipe them. Section 80 talks about monuments. This is just some standard language, but it is new in here. That talks about the permanent monuments that need to be furnished by the developer, and those shown on the subdivision plat. Oops, excuse me. Section 90 is a new section. It just requires that at the end of the installation of all the infrastructure that we receive CAD drawings of the as-built, so that we know where the new water lines, valves, manholes, laterals, where all of those things are in a CAD file that we can put into our GIS system. And then section 100 is a payback agreement. That's also a new section. So this provides a mechanism for the payback of offsite improvements that are requested by the city that are in excess of the minimum needed. So for instance, if a subdivision needed an 8-inch water line to provide water for the subdivision, but we wanted that water line to be a 10-inch water line, the city would pay for the difference between the cost of an 8-inch water line to a 10-inch water line, because we felt like we were gonna have more development at further down the line and we needed a larger capacity. But we can only make the developer pay for the infrastructure that is needed to serve just those lots in that development. So this provides a mechanism in the code for us to enter into a payback agreement. That is chapter 9. Any questions, comments, typos you found, concerns?
Just falls in the category, just out of curiosity. Mm-hmm. The section on roads talked about warranty. What's the normal warranty period on that? Just
one year.
Curiosity. 1 year?
Yep. So we have a 1 year warranty on our on the infrastructure that's put in.
And then I had just a small number. It looks great. Small number of suggested editorial considerations for your consideration. I'll just leave those with you.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Any other input? Thank you, Commissioner Jorgensen, for that. It looks really great.
I'm really excited to finish this project.
It's been a long time. How long has it been?
Oh, months.
Yeah.
Months
and so
months.
The open house will be in January?
The public hearing?
Oh, yeah. The public hearing,
the
yeah.
First meeting, your first meeting in January, so that it can go to the second meeting in January for the council, which is the 16th, because it needs to be adopted by February 1st.
You did
under
it.
The state statute, so.
Very cool.
Just under the wire, but that's just how it worked out. So we're excited to have it done.
Yeah, it looks great. Anybody else have anything that they want to add for Sherry or staff? Any other questions or anything that we can? All right.
Okay. For your action update. So this is going to be a little bit longer than normal because I didn't know how to tell you the things that we talked about at the last city council meeting without actually talking about them. So you may find them pretty interesting. I tried to condense some of this, but at our last city council meeting, we had a work session with the council, the engineering and planning department. We produced it together so that we could talk about some things. So one of the first things that we talked about was active transportation, sidewalk standards, bike lanes, and scooters. And so I wanted to give you some feedback, so or give you this information so that you had it and you could kind of understand what some of the code changes that we may be having come up in the future, or how when we are approving subdivision, what it means. Anyway, the first thing we want to cover was the sidewalk standards in the city. And so the ADA requires now that all public sidewalks be a minimum of 5 feet wide. So if you know around the city, we have 4 foot sidewalks and 5 foot park strips. What that would mean is if we're building a new street, then if we only had a 50 foot right of way, we would have a 5 foot sidewalk and a 4 foot park strip, or we need to increase our standards to 52 feet for the right of way. So it is possible that you can have 3 foot sidewalks as long as every 200 feet you have a passing zone. So a driveway or a concrete pad that's 5 feet by 5 feet. The idea is that if you were in a wheelchair and you were passing somebody else in a wheelchair, every 200 feet you could pull into this little area so that somebody else could pass you. In essence, when the policy will be that we will, when we have to replace broken sidewalk, we will replace it to match the existing sidewalk, because it doesn't make sense to have a 4 foot sidewalk and then we have to replace two sections because a tree roots lifted it, and then put a 5 foot section in for those two pieces, because that would actually create a safety hazard in that area. Where we're building all new sections of sidewalk, like for an entire street or in a street widening project, they will meet the 5 foot standard. But anytime we have to replace them, we're going to replace them with the existing, match the existing width that we have in that sidewalk. But we will be developing a new cross section for sidewalks and park strips. And we're also, as part of that, we're going to develop some cross sections for mixed use paths and sidewalks, so that we have a standard when we have an area that calls for a trail, we have a cross section that shows how wide that trail should be. And so those things are going to be adopted in the near future. We also showed the city council that we have these GIS maps that have our sidewalk inventory. So in the city, we have every street that has a sidewalk is blue, is shown here. Areas that do not have sidewalk are shown in red. That doesn't mean we're going to be planning to put sidewalks there. It's just identifying that's streets that we don't have it. And then we can make the city council can make policy and budget decisions in the future. Or if we get grants, we know where we can apply for grants, or we can identify needed sidewalk sections for safe routes to school. It's just kind of interesting to know that we do have this data all digitized and in our GIS system. And the engineering department keeps good track of what sidewalks we do have. Okay, so the next section, we wanted to talk about sidewalk width by zone, because not all sidewalks are created equally. And so what we wanted to do is look at our town center and various cross sections along Highway 89, and we're going to propose sidewalk widths based upon these zones. Now, it might be not zone in the way you would think of it, like an R110 zone or the CH zone, but more like this is the town center zone, and we would have a map. And so in the town center, on Center Street or on Highway 89, we want this cross section. So some of the things that we looked at is having the wider sidewalks, which we've talked about for a while, but establishing there's a frontage zone, there's a pedestrian zone, and there's the furnishing zone. Some of the other ideas that we are exploring is a cross-section with the wider sidewalk that gets a bicycle facility up behind the curb instead of a bike lane, so it's separated from traffic. But it's also striped or marked in some way so that it is a clear area for bicycles and maybe scooters. And then there's a clear area for where the pedestrians go. So you can see in those two pictures on the left, a couple of different ideas, one where there's the bike next to the bike and the pedestrian zones next to each other with a little sidewalk buffer in there. And then the one on the far right shows a bike lane behind the curb with the furnishing zone in the middle. So that's where we put the street lights and the park benches or the planter boxes or the street trees. And then the pedestrian zone is up against the building. The reason why I point this out is because we were brainstorming about the 130 East project and the bulb outs and the addition of the street parking. The way it's proposed right now, that street parking is actually out in to the travel lanes, and it's definitely in the bike lane. So we either need to not have the street parking or we have to move the bike lane. And so one of the thoughts we had was to ask the city council how supportive they might be of a scenario similar to the one that's on the far left, where we directed the bicycle up onto the sidewalk, had a wider cross-section for the sidewalk, put the planter boxes and street furnishings in between them, and then the pedestrian area would be closer to the building. And the city council asked us to explore that with that developer as a test to see how it might work out. Because as we were looking at what we've done over here across the street at City Center, we have some wider cross sections on Highway 89, and there appears to be enough room that if you were a pedestrian walking down there and a bicycle came along with proper signage and notification, that there would be enough room for them to coexist. And so we're going to explore that with that developer. So you may see that in 2 weeks when they're on your agenda. And yay, they're going to be on your agenda.
Not talking about the City Center, but Redwood Road. Is there a method of implementing this without that special district?
So on Redwood Road, we already have a cross-section on the west side for an 8-foot trail. And so you can have bicyclists and pedestrians on that. We were kind of trying to think in the urban setting, if we're going to do it in our town center, how might it work? And so we're just looking to see if there's enough room. We think that it will have to push their building back about 2.5 feet further to make sure that we have a good 5 feet for the bicycles and then 5 or 6 feet for the pedestrian zone and still have that furnishing zone in the middle. So we're exploring that with them to see how it might work.
So just out of curiosity, the Wasatch Choice Vision session and the idea of the UDOT-owned network of, what was it, family-friendly bicycle routes that are basically
yes.
separated from the vehicles. But I guess some of that's going to be designated in our city, but mm-hmm. I guess we can just account for what that needs to look like once they decide where they want to commit to that at.
Yeah, so in fact, Davis County is doing an active transportation plan, and we, myself and Allie and Karen, all went to a steering committee meeting today, or a stakeholder meeting today, where they have identified regional trail routes or active transportation facilities, and where we got to mark on a map which ones we think should be priority, and they'll take our considerations if it's in our area, so through our city, and then there'll be funding for this thing, for this. So if additional right-of-way has to be bought in order to do these side paths and get bike lanes off of this pavement in the street and the proper width. So we'll work closely with them as we work on our corridor agreement, and those are identified because there's a lot of money in the state at the state level for some of these things. So we're hoping to see some good. We got to pick our three top priority north-south routes and our three top priority east-west routes that we would like to see funded. So I picked Center Street and 1100 North, and those were really our only east-west. So I also said 1500 South and Bountiful. And then we picked Orchard and Highway 89 side path and actually Main Street and 1100 West to go up to the Front Runner Station. So where we might be able to get some of that funding in. So we're going to work really closely with that, and they'll have to be adjusted if we do something a little too small, but we're hoping we're planning ahead for that. So
yeah, no, that's great. I just thought it was interesting that UDOT's now going to start taking ownership and funding some of this. Yeah.
Yeah. And I brought up in the meeting that maintenance of these regional facilities really should be a county or some, there should be UDOT or it should be a county function when they're regional so that they're all maintained at the same level. I stopped working. Okay. So to that end, we are currently working with UDOT on a corridor agreement for Highway 89 and basically establishing a cross-section map from the entry to the city at the south all the way to 1100 North. And what our cross sections should look like. So what should our widths be? Should we have a center median? How big should it be? And should it, if it changes, there'll be places where the center median would be smaller. There'll be areas where it'd be wider. There'll be areas where we have turn pockets. So it will help us establish as redevelopment happens along Highway 89, how much right of way we need to request in those areas and really get that written down and agreed to by the city and UDOT so that 10 years from now or when leadership changes at UDOT, we have it in writing that they told us that this is what we could have. And when they rebuild it, that that's what we're going to have. So that'll go a long way with the BRT and the Davis Salt Lake commuter. But essentially that's what we're working on with the UDOT corridor agreement. As far as the active transportation in that corridor, we're thinking that on the north end from 350 North to about 1000 North, it should be a multi-use path on the west side of the highway. So right now, if you picture Highway 89, we have that really nice greenway with the tall trees and we have a 4-foot sidewalk and then we have about a 4-foot trail that kind of meanders. We'd like to take the sidewalk out and take that trail and put that together and make a wider multi-use path through those trees and that green space. Instead of having a separate sidewalk from the trail, have one wider facility. So that's what we're looking at doing with that section. In the center of the town center, we want to have it be a mixed use with wider sidewalks and passing areas similar to what we've done across the street here at the city center. And then on the south, so when you get to Eagle Ridge Drive, south of Eagle Ridge Drive, a separated path on the east side, which is what we already have, all the way down into Salt Lake City along Highway 89 with the I-15 expansion and the changes to Highway 89. So that's what we're lurking on for pedestrians and active transportation in our town center. And we're also looking at signage, things like that. One of the other things that we're looking at, again, this is to kind of show you what it might look like on the 130 East project. Essentially where the bike lane comes up when you get to the development, there would be some green paint on the road that would direct bicycles up onto the curb until you got up to where the up to Orchard Drive, and then it would go back into the bike lane, into the travel lanes. But we figured that that's a place where bikes and scooters could be off the street, but in a separate corridor. And these are just some examples of what that might look like. So the next thing that we want to talk to that we're looking at is some standards for our trail crossings. And one of the things that we are aware of and that we're trying to think about how we can do this is when you have a trail and it crosses a driveway or it crosses a street, what we want to do is make the trail the primary use. So whether that's through materials or painting, but it's the surface treatment, or whether it's a raised trail at a driveway crossing or at a street crossing, so that the the drivers of vehicles know when they're approaching a tail crossing that something's different. It signals to them that, hey, I'm crossing a pedestrian or a bicycle facility. I need to pay more attention, rather than having the street be just asphalt and the trails be a different pavement type out of that section. We want to continue that paving through that intersection so that the trail really feels like it continues and the road is the one that's invading that space, and it, you know, see how that works with the drivers. There's been a lot of studies on that's really helpful to drivers intuitively to know that they're approaching a bike lane rather than a bike lane having to be 100% responsible about their safety when they're crossing. But they're not exempt from that, so there's signage that we're exploring, you know, like, hey, driveway crossing ahead signs. So there's we want to make sure that there's safety features in place that make the driver of a vehicle safer and make the operator of a bicycle or a scooter safer. Some other things that we are exploring are bicycle and parking storage. So a couple of those pictures show you what's done in the Netherlands with bicycle parking at different facilities. I thought that was really interesting. They have these really cool racks that, you know, stack on top of each other, and they're really easy for people to get them down. So if we're looking at you know, a business or an apartment building, these are some ideas that we can use on how they can effectively provide bicycle storage and encourage active transportation. Some things just as simple as a sheltered bike rack. It can make bicycling more user-friendly because they, you know, their bike is going to be out of the rain while they get on the train and ride. So those are some other ideas that we're exploring. And again, the signage, auto-oriented plus bicycle and pedestrian-oriented. And then we talked about we have been working on a bike lane pilot program that we wanted to do for Orchard Drive. So at first we had the idea that we would do a pilot lane program, and we would put up orange cones. We would set it for a certain time period, maybe like 60 days. We'd have a kickoff event. We'd put out counters to see if that, you know, how much is being used by bicyclists or our citizens or residents. And then, so what we brought up with the council is a different idea, because just doing those cones, the budget cost was like $30,000. But doing a buffered bike lane with some paint and some of the new techniques with the green paint for bike lanes was less cost than doing the pilot project, because you have to buy or rent all of those cones, and then you have a lot of staff time that have to be out there and picking up. So we wanted to propose to the council that we look at doing a buffered bike lane with new signage, and rather than putting up no parking signs, we use the green paint. We use these bike lane signs and see if it changed behaviors of people who currently park in bike lanes, and see if we have a problem, because we can always do more later. We can always put up the red curb and put up the no parking signs, but if intuitively they're like, oh, we have this green paint, we have more markings on the road, like the standard right now is just to paint the bicycle at the intersection, right? It's not to paint the bicycles all the way down the bike lane to constantly remind people that that's a bike lane, and see if intuitively we can get people to not park in bike lanes. So that's our proposal. We're going to get that put in the budget for next year and try that on Orchard Drive. We're trying to get Bountiful to come on board with it, so that when we get to the city limits on Orchard, that they continue it all the way to the South Davis Rec Center on 200 West. Yeah, 200 West. So we're hopeful that they will participate, because that's one thing we want to do, is have a pilot project and see if providing this type of facility encourages and increases bicycle use in the city.
I just have one curiosity. So is the avoiding red paint to feel like the city gave you something rather than took something away?
I think it's
Is it a psychological concept that if you red paint, it's like you took the parking away, but if you green paint, it's like they added right. bike lane.
Yeah.
Is that the concept?
Yeah.
Very interesting.
So psychologically, it has an effect to say, hey, I'm not supposed to park my car here, but I don't feel like I've been
punished
or, you know, that's kind of the idea. So we'll see. Social experiments.
On the south end from Orchard Drive, we go down to the roundabout, and then how would you get from there over to the pathway going to Salt Lake?
So you know the roundabout, there's that vacant corner on the roundabout on the northwest corner. We actually, the city owns a right-of-way through that because the road used to go through that. There's only a small portion of that that actually is privately held, and we actually still have a 60-foot right-of-way. So we would like to come off of the street right there through that property, build the trail down, and we'll have to do some retaining, but get down to the intersection at Eagle Ridge. So instead of going through the roundabout, you're going to go down to the lighted intersection and then cross and get on the trail.
I think that would be really awesome, particularly if that, once you get down to Beck Street and that mess ultimately can,
yeah.
And I know it's in the I-15 EIS or whatever, but yeah. I think that would be really cool if that all could be done for particularly low cost, all the way up in the Bountiful.
Right. So that's our hope. So we're going to be working on that pilot project next year. I mean, assuming the city council puts it in their budget. We think we have their support for that amount of money that it's worth testing out. And if it tests really well, then that will become a new standard for our bike lanes when we paint them, is to paint them with this green paint.
Yeah, you did.
It seems to be working in a lot of other cities.
I noticed it too. That's the first time I noticed that.
So yeah. The next bit of information that we gave the city council was some update from Lime Scooters. As you recall, we approved the agreement with Lime Scooters back in February of this year, and they started deploying the scooters in the end of April, first part of May. So through October 31st, they've had almost 3,000 trips in the city. The average trip has been about a mile. The average rental time, so the duration, has been about 10 minutes. You know, they have an average number of scooters of around 22 deployed in the city each day. And then some vehicle hours in operation, that's really high. They've only had 17 customer service complaints. And just for reference, the scooters are geofenced at our north boundary limit. So if you rent a scooter, as soon as you get to 1100 North, it will stop operating because you can't take it into Woods Cross or Bountiful because they don't have an agreement with them yet. But you can take a scooter and you could ride it into Salt Lake City. So you can go south. You can go anywhere in the city and you can go south as well outside the city. I contacted South Davis Metro Fire to see if they were aware, and EMS, if they were aware of any scooter accidents. And they don't have it correlated specifically in scooters, so they had to do a word search for scooters, and they couldn't find any accidents in that time period for scooters that needed EMS response. So we did have our police department tell us there was one accident in Hatch Park. The person did not need to be transported, and it was not involving cars or it wasn't a scooter and a pedestrian. It was a single user who may or may not have been distracted by a female that he was checking out. So a teenager that was maybe looking at somebody that and got, you know, showing off and got distracted and crashed and got a skin knee or something. So but we thought that was pretty good data for us.
What does the green and yellow indicate?
Oh, so that was when we initially approved the agreement with Lime. The green sites were the sites that they had identified on places where that they would test deployment, and then the yellow ones were sites that we suggested that they might want to try as well. And so the way they have their algorithm, when they have somebody goes into the apps and starts looking for a scooter, they log where that person is. And based upon the number of times people are looking in those locations, they'll start deploying them in those locations. So I don't have a map of the most deployed locations. That was some follow-up that the city council wanted me to get, is where are they really mostly deploying? Where are people using them the most? So, but you probably see them around town, and
they're working great in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
People are using them a lot.
Great.
Just like from Lee's and stuff, just like around into the school. It's fun to see.
It's pretty fun to see. We used them when we did the town market study, when we had our consultant here. That's what that lower picture is on the right. We did a tour of the town center and showed them all around the different. We rode down to Eaglewood Village, and then we came up Orchard, and we came down Center Street, and we went all the way up to 350 North, and then came down the other side and over to Hatch Park. And
did you guys ride on the sidewalk? Or in the road?
We did ride on the sidewalk.
I'm not judging, just curious.
Yeah. We violated that part, but it really wasn't a big deal. We didn't run into any pedestrians.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel dangerous at all. So I know that there are some complaints in downtown Salt Lake where they have a lot of pedestrians activity. We don't have that much pedestrian activity, but we want to plan for when we do have more pedestrian activity and provide multi-use paths. Is what we would like to do. We'd like to at least test that out. And if we don't have any conflicts, then I think that would be one of the best things to have separated from the street traffic. The next update that I provided for them was on our general plan. So the RFP for our general plan was released last Tuesday. We had a pre-submittal meeting today. We had 7 consultants come to the meeting just to gather information. So we went over what all of our plans are that we have, that we've done since 2012. So the active transportation plan, the moderate income housing plan, the town center circulation study, the town center master plan, a couple other plans that I can't think of right now, answered questions about the things that are going on, the redevelopment that we've had, the things that we're expecting with I-15 reconstruction and Highway 89, BRT, and we had some really good questions asked by the consultants, so we're really excited. We have the proposals will be due on December 5th. The staff will then review them and rank them by December 18th. If we don't have a firm that is definitely everyone's favorite, if we can only, we will reduce it to about 2 finalists, and then we'll have them make some presentations to us, and then the committee will make a recommendation to the city council for the selection on January 16th, and then February or March we'll be starting in earnest the general plan update. So we're really excited about that. It was a big effort to get that RFP out. I had no idea you had to put so much into it. But it's in the works now, so I've got the subdivision ordinance almost done, and now we'll be starting the general plan. The next thing that we reported on is the town center urban design, and so this answers our question about form-based code. As we've been trying to work through the form-based code over the last few years, it's kind of became apparent to us as a staff that the template just really is not the right fit for the scale or the scope of our town center. We always felt like we were trying to jam a square peg into a round hole, and we just couldn't make it fit because we don't have the expertise on what the right setbacks should be, what the right height should be, what the right massing should be. And the template for the form-based code is not a plug-and-play template. If you don't have the experience with that type of code, it's really hard to implement it. Even where it's being successfully implemented in South Salt Lake and Clearfield, for instance, I had looked at Clearfield's, went online because I knew they had done the template, and then I looked online and their form-based code is totally different. And so I called them. I'm like, what did you do? How did you get from the template to what you have right now? And they're like, oh, we hired a consultant. It cost $75,000. But they came in, and FFKR came in and rewrote that whole thing so that it makes sense. It's harder to make it make sense here because we have such long frontages along Highway 89, but narrow depths. And so it's really hard. And then right up against single family houses, I feel like it's really hard to fit that in. So what we have done is we sent a letter of interest to Wasatch Front Regional Council for a TLC grant. and that's the Transportation Land Connection Grants. They have given the green light for us to apply for that grant, invited us to apply for a grant to hire an architectural consultant to draft for us some IRMA design guidelines. So what we're looking for from our an architectural consultant would be to do some site and block massing recommendations, height, building articulation, pedestrian spaces, materials and colors, and really get us some architectural design guidelines, do some site-specific demonstrations so we can take like those properties that are to the south of the post office and say, if you were redesigning this, what's the right massing? What's the right size of footprints for these, for redevelopment on that? What's the right type of residential use if we're gonna put that on there? What's the right type of commercial use? And then those architectural guidelines can be integrated into a town center zone district regulations. So we're really looking for a professional architectural firm to help us with those guidelines. We're hopeful that we'll get that awarded to us in the summer of 2024, and we'll be able to integrate that with our general plan update and update of our vision documents so that we know we're on track with what the citizens want us to be in our town center redevelopment. So those were the items that we covered in the work session with the city council last time. I wanted to make sure that you had that and knew some of the other things that we're working on, because obviously they're going to be coming before you for adoption and recommendation to the city council. Do you have any question about any of all of that?
So do we strike form-based code from our vocabulary?
Yes, please.
That's 4 years.
It's 4 years we can't get back. But at least the staff won't be pulling out their hair and banging their heads against the wall trying to figure out how to make it work. So that's where we're at. And then also we updated them that there's some other things that we're working on are the subdivision ordinance update, where we're talking about the street right-of-way widths, the sidewalks and trails. We're working on a capital facility plan with engineering for active transportation. So we have the active transportation plan, and it makes all these great recommendations for projects, but we don't have any funding mechanism for those. So every time we go to do an active transportation project, it's going to come out of some other budget, like a parks budget or a streets budget. And so what we would like to do is we're going to take all of those recommendations out of them, out of the plan, prioritize them in a five-year plan and say, okay, City Council, this is what we think we should do the first year, and this is how much it's going to cost. And then we can project those 5 years out, and the City Council can give us direction of what projects they think we should have in those priorities or move those projects up and down, and then provide a budget stream for the improvements and actually really implement our active transportation plan. So we're excited to do that. And then integrating some of those profiles and standards into our spec manuals and ordinances that need to be updated. So we have a lot of work that we're doing that you don't see, but we're super excited to implement our plans.
Thank you. What is going on with the North Lake?
So they will be back on the agenda in 2 weeks. So they have reduced the, should I ruin the suspense?
Yes, please.
They have reduced to 79 dwelling units.
Was last time 98?
96, 97,
right,
I think.
Around there. What is it now?
So now they're down to 79.
Okay.
They shrunk the footprint down a little bit on the west building so that they could add an outdoor patio area for a restaurant on that first level. So it improves the parking ratio and reduces the number of dwelling units.
Okay, and is that a public hearing?
It will be a public hearing, yes.
Cool.
So we'll be sending out those notices tomorrow.
Did you ever get the data you were looking for on the demand for those small type of units? the market demand?
The parking, we have not started that, but we are working on that survey because that's something that we're going to have to do going door to door. So that will not be completed.
Yeah, not the parking, but the demand for those teeny little
the market demand,
yes. The occupancy or whatever.
So we have the final draft. We're just going through our final revisions with the consultant. And then that will we have better idea of what kind of things we can attract, and it really will be more service related or activity related. And there is a need for those smaller units basically, because we're not going to attract a Trader Joe's as much as everybody would like that. We just don't have the market for it. That if we had the market for Trader Joe's, they'd be here already. But yeah, so it looks pretty good, and it gives us some insight and some things that we need to do. But it's kind of more along the lines of what we should be focusing on is activities for our residents and services, and not necessarily retail sales, but you know, nail salons or hair barbers and hair salons and axe throwing, or you know, small types of
we take that out of our uses,
kind of things that bring you to do activities, you know.
I have a question also. I can't remember the correct term for this, but how he was saying some of the units were in terms of like lower, not, I can't remember the right term, like not lower income, but
moderate income.
So how is there a formula for how that's calculated? Like, or like a, how much square foot, or do you know what I mean? Cause I kind of had the impression that they were just like, well, this is at a certain cost. And so it fits into that category, but does that take into account how big it is as well? Or is it taken into account how many people are in there?
So those are two different questions. So how much that they have to charge in rent directly correlates back into how much they have to build, you know, what land costs they have and the construction costs and the operating costs and the materials that they use for all of that. So then, but then in order for those numbers to correlate to being a moderate income, those numbers are set by HUD. And so it's based on our median income and household size. So it's different if you're a one person household, the maximum that you can make or the maximum that you can spend and the maximum amount that you make fit into that. So it's really a kind of an equation of, this is how much
is
the market
HUD's,
rate
though,
is for these.
Formula based at all on how big?
No.
Okay, so it's just based on number of people and
your income.
And income.
Yeah. And so we get over to when we're building, when we figure out, they have to figure out their pro forma, right? And this is how much it costs. This is what our rent rate is.
I feel like that was kind of one of their, they were trying to say, oh, the selling point is like, oh, well, we do fit into this HUD, like whatever income, but it really is because the units are so small that they can't charge more than a certain amount. Okay.
Yes.
Got it.
So, I mean, on the flip side of that, if you are in those moderate or lower income ratios, what can you afford from what you, I mean, you know, you're not going to get a mansion on the hill when you're at the 80% AMI, right? So there's an expectation there that it is a smaller apartment, or it's an apartment that's lower. It doesn't have as many amenities, or it doesn't have as nice of finishes, right?
Older.
It's older. So do you want something new and shiny, and you want it to still meet that, then it's going to be smaller. If you want to go down on the quality of the construction, then it can get a little bit bigger, but they still have to meet this threshold of that's established by HUD for moderate income housing and income levels. So their selling point in their mind is that this market rate for this size of unit actually fits into just what would be brand new.
So they're not going to do anything to make that be concrete. that it has to be in the moderate.
They're not asking they're for just any saying, subsidies.
They said that just the market would
right.
account for that because they can't charge more because it's so small. So the market would account for it stays within
oh,
that.
I know.
Do you know what I mean? So
I'm
it's kind
to
of like
a sarcastic comment.
I don't know if that's really.
But because they're not asking, they're not asking for any subsidies from the city to help finance the construction cost or subsidize the rental rates on this end, then we wouldn't be able to put in a requirement that they stayed within these moderate incomes. So, I mean, in 10 years from now, if the market can demand higher rents for these smaller units, there wouldn't be anything that we could do to stop them. I mean, we'd have to have rent control, and we're not in California.
So, Sherry, just out of curiosity, if I understand it correctly, under state regulations, we're accountable to the state for periodically reporting where we're at on that moderate income. So
yes.
Where something like this would be market at presumably the 80% AMI, do you get to take credit for that?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Yes, because under our guidelines, we are allowing smaller units or we are allowing higher density per acre, those types of actions, we do get to count towards our requirements, which incidentally, we just got a letter from our report. We reported to the state. We have to report each year. If you complete actions in three of your strategies towards moderate income housing, you receive a passing grade and you qualify for transportation funding. If you do five, you get priority funding. We did five and we were awarded priority status funding. So that means when we apply for grant money, we will rank higher than other cities that didn't meet that threshold. We kind of got dinged on one thing because we submitted a sixth thing that we did. We said, hey, by the way, state, it's not in our plan, but we annexed this area and then we basically upzoned it from the R1 zoning in the county to an R17, which allows the smaller lot sizes and the duplexes. And they said, that's cute. I mean, it was basically, you know, here, that's really cute, but, and we really appreciate that, but if you want it to count towards your, toward those five priority things, then you have to go back in and amend your plan first before you do the annexation, then do the annexation and the rezone, and then report it. So we can't even report something retroactive, but we'd never had expected that we, you know, we hadn't planned when we wrote the report that we would get the moderate, you know, that we would annex that area. That wasn't on our radar when we did that. So now we basically are going, okay, well, from now on, when we're going to take an action that we think supports moderate income housing, then we're going to amend our plan first before we take that action and then take that action so that we get credit for it. Because that's kind of how restrictive the state code is, and in their review of our plans is they're very narrow. They're like, well, if you didn't specifically put that in your plan, even if it is something that supports affordable housing, we're not going to give you credit for it because you didn't have it in your plan first, which to me seems counterintuitive. Like it should be, hey, great work. You actually went above and beyond what you put in your plan, right? But I guess they don't look at it that way. So.
Okay, one more question. Can you kind of just clarify what our role specifically is during the public hearing for this specific case? Because sometimes I get a little, you know, things become out of focus sometimes.
So, so your role is to listen to the concerns that the public are raising, and then to take those concerns and determine which of those concerns are valid, right? Ones that you have that's within your authority to do something about. So let's say if there's a concern, like somebody raises a concern in a public hearing that, hey, there's this ditch that runs right through this property. It's going to be dangerous for kids. and you're going through the approval process, and you're like, well, hey, we can require a fence around that ditch to keep that from, you know, if there's something, a condition that you can place on it that helps mitigate that concern, then that's your role to do that. But sometimes if it's just, we think this is gonna bring more traffic, that's not necessarily something that, yeah, we know it's gonna bring more traffic, but is the more traffic it going to bring, is it really that big of a problem? You have to do the, you have to kind of do the math sometimes. So like if you looked at, if we looked at an apartment building, I'm just gonna round this off to in hundreds so it will be easier. Okay, so if we have 100, if we have an apartment complex with 100 dwelling units, and the trip generation, daily trip generation for that that type of use, so for a single family use, each single family home usually generates 10 vehicle trips a day. So that means I leave my house and I go to the store. That's one trip. When I leave the store and come back, that's two trips. So the on average, every house has generates about 10 trips per day. An apartment generates on average 6 trips per day. Okay. So if I have 100 dwelling units and each one of those generate 6 trips per day, that's 600 trips per day. But they don't all leave at the same time, right? So you have to think about that and go, okay, well, those 600 trips, let's say 95% of them happen between 6 a.m. and 9 p.m. or let's see, whatever, let's just say it's 10 hours so we can do easy math in a 10-hour period. So 600 vehicle trips over 10 hours, which is 600 minutes. And so that's one vehicle trip every minute, 1 minute. There's one more car on the road. Does that one car per minute additional on those streets, is that going to slow down? Is that beyond the capacity of that road to handle? Can that road handle one more car every minute in that 10-hour period? So you have to weigh those types of...
Okay. One more question. For example, is the Planning Commission, could the Planning Commission say, like, for a lot of the concerns are about parking, right? And so could the Planning Commission say something like restricting one vehicle per those micro apartments, or is that something?
In this case, yes, you can recommend that because this is a legislative change and we're doing a development agreement. So when we recommend to the city council, or when you recommend to the city council if they approve this or deny this, you can say our recommendation is that the parking management strategy be placed in the development agreement, that the developer agrees that the micro units, that they will be managed so that each one of the tenants in each one of those units are afforded a maximum of one car per unit. Right, like you could say that, okay. Or we can say, you know, that they manage their parking in this way. If there's some solution to that, then that's how you can do that. And if the developer agrees to that condition, you and the Planning Commission and City Council agree to that condition, then they can jointly agree and sign that development agreement. If the developer doesn't feel like that's workable, and he's not willing to do that, then he doesn't have to sign the development agreement and he doesn't get the approval to do that. So yes, those are things that you can do.
Also a reminder that this was a different application, not saying what direction we're going, but part of the reason that this has been so complicated is this came through with a different deal. And so they're asking for a different deal. So in the same way that the applicant can be like, I don't want to take those terms because it's a legislative item, we still have that power within our purview to say, well, then we want to go back to the old deal that you already signed, and that is the deal that is attached to this property, even though it's transferred hands. So they are also asking the city to make some big accommodations to the original agreement, which may or may not be in the benefit of the city. It might be a great idea. It might not. And that is also part of the discussion that we're having that night, is does this new development, is it in the better interest for North Salt Lake in immediate and long-range use than what the original agreement was?
Yeah. Yeah, because they're asking for legislative change, which is why the whole reason we are having a public hearing. If it were a subdivision and they had R1 or RM20 zoning right now, we wouldn't be having, we would not have that conversation, because they came in and they met the 2.25 parking spaces per unit. They met the 20 units per acre, whatever. They met all the minimum standards. There's no negotiation. So this is a totally different situation, because it's a legislative change, and we are entering into a development agreement with them that the city goes into voluntarily, they go into it voluntarily. If we can come to terms on those types of items, then, and both parties find it acceptable, we can enter into that agreement with them.
And that's because it's zoned as a P district, right?
Right.
Yeah. And just by way of clarification through the training, I do think it's important on any given action that we do understand whether it's administrative, or in other words, it meets the standards, and really our only option is to approve it, whether we like it or not, but, you know, does it meet the standards, or something like this that we're talking about that is legislative. And I use the small L because ultimately the city council has the capital L and they get the final say. And I'm sure the developer would like to get it out of our hands into the next step in this particular case. But I do think on any given application, it would be helpful, just so everybody on the Planning Commission understands, is it administrative or is it legislative? If it's administrative, your only job is to figure out if it meets the requirements.
Right. So in this action right now, we're doing legislative. If they get to the city council and the changes are approved in the development agreement, and now we've established what all the rules are, when they come back for a site plan review with their full civil drawings, they have to meet all of the standards that are in the development agreement, and then that site plan approval is administrative. That action is administrative because we've already decided what all the terms of the zone are in that development agreement. And then they come back for site plan approval. And as long as they meet all the terms that we put into the development agreement, then they get approval. There's no public hearing anymore. This is the time for the public hearing when we're doing the legislative.
How do we have no stick to enforce the original development agreement? Was that a fault?
Still have a stick.
We don't. Them. There's never going to be an office building there. They're not going to build one.
Yeah.
So, but we have nothing to punish them or anything.
We can revert it back to the original CS zoning, right? Like, we're going to have to do something. We're either going to have to take them to court to force them to come and fulfill the terms of the development agreement, and they could be found liable, and if they don't, they could be fined. You know, we could ask for damages, those types of things. So we have avenues to the court. Is that advantageous to us? Does it really get anything? Or the other action would be, okay, well, if you're not going to fulfill the terms of the development agreement, then we're going to downzone it back to the original zoning, which was the commercial shopping zoning, and then you can have whatever the terms are under that ordinance only, right? If you want to do something else, you're going to have to come back and ask us for a zone change,
which is also a legislative item.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Can we do that? Because I agree with Commissioner Tucker, then there's never going to be two office buildings right there. Do we have the power to take a P district back and say CS zone?
For inaction of the development agreement, if they don't fulfill the terms, we still have to go through the steps to try and get them, to see if we can get them to fulfill the terms. If they can't, then we have the option. We have to hold public hearings. There's a procedure in the code that we can do that. So I think the question is, if it goes from Planning Commission to City Council and the City Council says no, and they don't want to amend the development agreement, then we need to ask the City Council, okay, well, do you want to direct us? Because if they direct us to now go back and let's get it reverted back to the original zone, then that would be what would happen. They would ask us to hold public hearings and we would come back in and revert the zoning to some other zone.
What's the time limit on the original development agreement?
I think, development agreements are good for 10 years.
Okay.
Usually we put those in for 10 years. But if they didn't do anything for 2 years, then we have the right under our ordinance to go back in and do that. It still is something that the City Council needs to decide. Yeah, as a policy, we would like we're going to exercise this part of the code and we're going to go through the public hearings and rezone it back to
Okay. I remember the two-year part. I didn't know if there was a continuous
yes.
construction aspect to it or not, but it's just a 10-year limit.
Yes, so there's okay. a 10-year limit on the window, but if there's this period of time where they absolutely don't do any action, they're not trying to do any construction, they're not trying to get any modifications, we're very patient, I think I should say, with our development agreements and understanding market conditions, and so we give them the time for the market conditions to be right. Like, we have a development agreement with Williamsburg, but they haven't started construction yet. But we also understand the market and the interest rates and the construction costs. And so we don't want a project to start and fail. So we want to be patient with those things. If it's a project that we want, we'll be patient with them. If it's a problem of performance of the developer, or the developer takes out bankruptcy and disappears, dissolves, right, then we have no one to enforce on anyway, because the LLC that we signed the development agreement doesn't exist anymore, then we would want to go and have that out and go back and rezone it to something else.
Just going back to Commissioner Jorgensen's comment, there was a time that on the agenda the staff was putting whether an item was administrative or legislative. Would the commission like to have that added back into the agenda? So it, what it had, do you remember this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so on each agenda item, they would just put in parentheses whether that item was legislative or administrative, to just kind of give clarity on the role on that item.
Yeah, Commissioner Jorgensen, my opinion is yes. And I think simply for the reason that when you do get a new planning commissioner who's not been privy to these discussions, from day one, they can ask, what's the difference? And
right.
from day one, they can begin to understand, you know, what your role is and where you have more latitude and where you have less.
Yeah.
That's something we can do.
That would
help me
be great.
Remember that.
If you could
yeah.
add that back
do
in.
Our best.
Thank you. We are not hard to please, so even if you miss it sometimes, we are.
You guys are terrific.
We are a gentle audience, but yeah, that might be good to add back in just as a reminder. All right, any other comments or questions? Anything else from you, Sherry?
I'll just let you know at the next city council meeting on December 6th, the mayor is going to propose to reappoint Commissioner Jorgensen and Commissioner Holbrook
awesome.
To second terms.
Oh, in this, yes.
Sorry.
We're excited. You can lobby in the meantime, though. You still got time. Lobby against.
We are excited to have them continue, because then we don't have to train somebody new, and you guys are doing a terrific job, and so we love to have you. Yeah, I mean, we love you, but we also, I don't have to search for anybody, and that makes me happy too. So I like being happy on both sides.
All right, holiday party.
You put this slide in.
Well, I put it in just as a reminder. And Bree, are you going to come?
Yeah, I RSVP'd.
Heck yeah, you did.
I did. I never do that, but I did.
I don't pay attention to the RSVP list, but it's more of a reminder that it is happening on December 1st, which will be here before we know it. So
yes.
Just up at Eaglewood Golf.
Maybe next year we should have Brandon's band be the entertainment.
I'll have to duke it out with the Marigolds.
Very fun. All right, thank you for the reminder.
Next year we should have it at Hank's Garage.
Oh, yeah, that'd be so fun.
Yeah, if we can get his approvals.
All right, and the meeting minutes from October 24th. Any amendments to the minutes? If there's none, we can have Ron do a motion.
See, this is why you want me to re-up, because I can make life easier at the end. We'll all sit here for 10 minutes and look at each other. Commissioner Jorgensen, I make a motion that we approve the minutes as drafted for the October 24th, 2023 Planning Commission meeting.
Thank you. And do we have a second?
I'll second.
Commissioner Moss. Commissioner Moss. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Okay. Thank you. And we are adjourned.
I was hoping you'd make an official motion.